Hi everyone, welcome back to Mohawk Podcast, where we discuss everything about Old World. I'm your host for today, I'm Dale, and joining me today we have No Legs Kitten from Discord.
Hello.
And also on the panel today I have Josh.
Hey there.
Now, Josh, you'll probably remember him from the Pharaohs podcast, which was the last one. He joined me with Solver. But today, we are going to be discussing a brand new DLC that we have come out with, and that is the Wonders and Dynasties DLC.
Yeah.
Yes, at last.
But before we go into the DLC, we're just going to talk about No Legs Kitten and Josh and their roles within the Mohawk team. So, No Legs, how would you describe your role within Mohawk?
Well, I'm a game designer, but I've been working on many different tasks, a bit of production, programming, bug fixing. I've built the heal scenario, the announcement panel, a few things here and there.
And not forgetting that you're quite active within the MP community.
Indeed. Well, I come from the Discord community of Old World, that's how I joined. And I'm still quite an active MP player, and also I stream regularly on our official channel.
And Josh, people will remember probably from the Pharaohs podcast, but for those who are new joining us, how would you describe your role within Mohawk?
So I'm a designer and writer, so I've recently worked on various DLCs. I wrote the events for the Sacred and Profane event pack, and then, like we were talking about last time, designed the Kush faction. And then, yeah, with this Wonders and Dynasties pack, I worked on the Rome Dynasties.
Awesome. And myself, within the Mohawk team, well, A, I'm the host of Mohawk Podcast, and I'm also quite involved within the Old World community, and I do a bit of game design and programming, looking after, well, of course, I was the scenario designer for the Pharaohs campaign, plus also with Wonders and Dynasties, I looked after Egypt, and I also, in the base game, created the tutorials, the mod browser, and I look after all the modding side of it, plus also some other projects. But today what we're going to be talking about is Wonders and Dynasties, the new DLC that is out for Old World. So as a very quick introduction, it's pretty easy to understand what Wonders and Dynasties is all about. It's about new wonders and new dynasties. Dynasties, of course, being a feature that we introduced with the Greek nation with Heroes of the Aegean, plus also extended it with Kush and their dynasties with the Pharaohs of the Nile DLC. So now we have come up with dynasties for all the other nations, and that's part of this pack. So, the first question everyone's probably wondering is, why Wonders and Dynasties? Why did we choose to extend them in this DLC?
Well, I think one of the main impetus, after some of the feedback we received for our first DLCs, is that a large proportion of our audience really wanted to have content that is designed to affect every game. And so that's pretty much what we focused on. The dynasties as well felt pretty successful and quite an interesting way to put a new twist on the ways to play the game and offering different possibilities without as much concern for balance, for instance. So it was an open subject, and we thought it would be cool to have less scenario-focused content for the game. Of course, we already have had event packs, but just more content for every game.
Yes, yeah, so a big bit of it is, I think a lot of it's just getting the different variety in there. So at the moment, there's already a system where a certain number of wonders are picked every game, and having more of them in there, is, you know, you're still not going to be able to build every wonder in every game, but it just changes up the variables of, similar to having playing on a different map, having different wonders available, or having a different dynasty. So the characters you're starting with and their family tree, their unique abilities, all of these, it's a new element that, you know, you've got to carve play off, and makes you come up with new strategies and play the game a bit differently.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting bit that was maybe not fully exposed by the base game, because not all wonders are available in the game, but we had a set of 16 wonders, and since 13 are available, it's not always that big of a change. With a larger pool of wonders, they contribute, the pool of available wonders to build contributes more to produce a more varied setup, let's say, from the start of the game.
Yeah, and I really liked that with the Wonders and Dynasties DLC, we basically took the cap off forcing ourselves to ensure everything was completely balanced and leave that for like the default leaders and default wonders, and actually be able to get the opportunity to stretch our thinking caps and come up with some really unique and really fun new styles to be able to play these leaders. Like, we have leaders, some of them more focused towards easier play, and then we've got some characters, some new leaders who bring in traits and abilities that, I don't know, it's hard to describe, other than just insane, and it just completely turns the whole game upside down and provides a new fun way to get into the game.
I think it ties up as well with the way we designed it, because essentially designers in the team picked nation they wanted to work with, and of course we all exchanged feedback and adjust things and all that, but it was cool to have a bit of some creative space, and it makes everyone think about the variety they want to provide within a single nation. So you can do a little bit of everything with every nation with the combination. And also, since we all got our focus, that's something I enjoy very much. I still have much to discover about the DLC myself, because, of course, I've playtested a few, but far from all of them. So I still have a lot to find out about the dynasties in particular. And that's very enjoyable. So I hope the space of possibilities will be as open for audience, for our players.
Oh, absolutely. And even just reading on Discord, you know, the way other players outside of the development team are playing some of these new dynasties, it's really opened my eyes as to how flexible some of them are, in that I've played these characters one way, and, you know, other players are coming along and playing the characters completely different to how I even thought the character would take the game.
Yeah, sure. I guess it's always very gratifying to see what other people do with what you thought about or what you had in your mind, and it gets a life of its own. I guess it's a common thing to say, probably, but I'm still a new designer, so I do still discover and enjoy that very much for myself.
I think it's probably true to say also that all of us at Mohawk who were involved with this new DLC, we're just having so much fun reading and watching how our players are actually taking, you know, Wonders and Dynasties, and, you know, hearing their feedback and just seeing how much fun they're getting out of the new varied ways to play, and the new wonders, of course, with their special powers.
Yeah, and I guess we tried to invent something new with the wonders and have new mechanics as well. So that's also a thing. We are, let's say, privileged compared to modders because we can just add capabilities to the main game, but that becomes available as well for the modding community in particular to be able to use those new tools and effects and capabilities that the game provides.
And just a shout out to Harry, one of our most prolific modders. I know he's pretty jealous that we're able to just, oh, I wonder what this does, bang, 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 and then get to play it in the game. And throughout all of the design approach with Wonders and Dynasties, we had our benevolent designer leader, Soren, overlooking all of our comments and feedback and suggestions, and he was really good in providing feedback to ensure that we didn't go too far out of field.
Yeah, absolutely. All hail the benevolent leader.
This will also prove whether he listens to our podcasts.
Oh, for sure. I'm sure he will.
So in this section of the podcast, we're just going to talk about each of the wonders, and then we're going to move on to the dynasties. But with the wonders, the DLC is introducing 8 new wonders. Al-Khazneh, which if you play other games, you may know as Petra. There is also the Colosseum, the Kothon, the Heliopolis, the Jebel Barkal, the Jerwin Aqueduct, the Royal Library, and Yazilikaya. And I can guarantee I completely butchered most of those names. So don't rip me.
We will happily butcher the same names as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, why do you think we left them to you to read out?
Thanks. So we'll firstly talk about Al-Khazneh. It gives you 3 caravans when it's completed, and it also adds 20% money to connected cities. So that's a pretty good one for trader families, I feel. I don't normally play with trader family nations, so I haven't really focused on this wonder too much.
Well, I think caravans are an interesting mechanic because they have sort of 2 components. Of course, they bring great economic boons with money, but there's also the diplomatic benefit in single player in particular. So I guess we went a bit adventurous with some of the wonders and this one among them, because it doesn't really directly work, this part of the bonus, new caravans, if you're playing in a duel. But that's sort of a niche case. And on the other hand, if you're playing team games or FFA, caravans work diplomatically with humans because they get the benefit as well. So we think it's quite cool in that way. And as usual, we named it Al-Khazneh rather than the more commonly named Petra, because that's the original name. Petra is the name of the place today. So that's the name of the temple complex that is illustrated by the wonder.
Yeah, we should preface all of these in saying that, as usual, we have focused on what they were known locally as. So locally, it was known as Al-Khazneh, as opposed to Petra, which we know it as now. And the next wonder we'll move on to is the Colosseum. I mean, pretty much everyone knows the Colosseum from Rome.
It's a classic.
Exactly, it is a classic. And it's one that we really had to add. It's one that we all wanted.
I think that's the one that most often came up, that people were surprised that it wasn't in the base game.
Yeah, it's definitely, let's say, one of the best known remaining monuments from antiquity with... Well, I guess the pyramids are even older than antiquity, but but for sure, those are the 2 poster boys of World Wonders, probably, even if the Colosseum didn't make the original cut, I guess.
Now, this is one of the wonders I absolutely love out of the new ones. So the Colosseum actually creates a swordsman every five turns. And I love this for my own play because it means I don't then have to focus on my frontline melee units within my cities because I'm getting one every five turns. I'll still build some, but I don't have to focus so much. I can spend my resources more on archers and you know, siege units.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also my favorite wonder of the DLC for another reason entirely, but it's the first wonder we made for the DLC, and that's the first one I saw being built by our artists, and the painting of the Colosseum and the model being built felt like magic to me. Mm. Because I haven't worked on that side of thing before, so that was definitely it made a strong impression completely independently of what it does in the game. That was the first one for me, still some form of favorite, I guess.
Yeah, the event painting is absolutely amazing, which I should add are now available in the game after the recent main update.
Yeah, unfortunately we had a bit of some delays at the release, but those paintings will now be in the game, and it might be my favorite painting of the DLC, the Colosseum. Mm-hmm. And I was blown away seeing this whole new painting just coming up from the artist, and I guess all the more shocking because it was the first one I ever saw come up that way, and it still feels like magic to me. So.
And the third wonder we'll discuss is the Cothon. Now, this is one that was originally in Carthage, and Carthage being more of a naval nation than some of the others. We've focused on a naval ability for a wonder. And this one gives plus a new ship unit, get plus one level, plus 10 XP per turn for ship units. Now, that's if they're stationary in the wonder. And it's a spawn point for the ship unit, similar to what Harbour does when you gain ships. And lastly, it also creates a trireme every 10 turns. I must admit, I tend to play more land-based games, so this is a wonder I haven't really played much with, but I can see how it would be extremely useful on like inland sea games or Archipelago especially.
Absolutely, it has proven to be a game ender in some of the playtest game we had with Fluffy Bunny, with whom I'm playing quite a bit. Well, it's been toned down a little bit since then, but I guess similar to the Colosseum, it's just cool to have some ship units, and you don't have to research the tech to get them either. So it offers a, let's say, a different way to access some of the abilities in the game that way. So, yeah.
And being only a strong culture wonder, it's actually accessible quite early compared to, say, the Colosseum, which is a legendary one which gives you the swordsman.
Yeah, absolutely. So originally it was spawning Dromans in playtest, and that was a bit too strong, a shortcut, let's say, through the tech tree at that time. But we feel it's in a pretty good place, and I mean, not all maps are suitable for it, but when it's available, naval movement in particular is very powerful. So I think this wonder packs quite a bit of impact still.
All right, the next wonder we're on to is the Heliopolis. In my opinion, this is a must-have if you're a pagan player. If you like to focus on your pagan religion, then you're going to want the Heliopolis because it will give you one order per turn for every shrine in every city. And to me, that's like a lifesaver in the end game when you need those orders.
Yeah, absolutely. It's enormous in its effect. So it needs the right combination, but that's something you can reasonably aim for from earlier on and say, oh, I want to reach legendary to get that one. So the Circus Maximus has a similar effect in the base game, but there are definitely wonders in Wonders and Dynasty, well, both legendary wonders, this one and the Colosseum, that are very rewarding, I feel.
Yes, if you can set up your infrastructure correctly, this one will pay off massive returns. And the next wonder is probably my favourite one of the DLC, because I tend to play a more religious game, focusing on clerics' families, and that is the Jebel Barkal. Now, this wonder, when it's completed, in every city that has a religion, will add a temple of that world religion. So this can be quite a big one, as long as you put in the effort to set it up correctly. So if you've got a lot of cities with your state religion, complete the Jebel Barkal and bang, you'll get a temple in every one of those cities.
Yeah, there's a bit of risk reward there. If you can hold off for long enough, it can have such a massive bonus later in the game.
Yeah, it is available quite early, being a developing culture wonder. But if you're really quick and you have a city dedicated to pumping out those disciples to spread the religion across your cities, then this one can actually pay off quite a high reward.
Well, potentially it can pay its worth in stone directly if you've got enough cities, because, I mean, the stone cost is about 13 temples, something like that. So yeah, it can definitely be super strong.
And the next wonder on our list is the Jerwin Aqueduct. Now, this one's a bit more unique in how it acts on the map, in that it will create the actual aqueduct and then run water lines out to your actual tiles, which is quite fun and quite unique. So it acts as a source of fresh water, and it gives a free farmer in adjacent farms.
Yeah, it's true that it's very unique, because for the design of all wonders in the game, we try to base ourselves as much as possible on the remains of existing wonders and what is known about them, or let's say some of the common ways to imagine them when there's no remnants. But the German aqueduct is different, because it's quite well known. The ruins are identified, they are in a good state, we have a pretty good idea of what it looked like, but we departed from that because it's, well, the first aqueduct, or the first large bridge aqueduct, but it's part of a huge irrigation network that was built in a relatively short time in Assyria, and so we thought it would be interesting to try to have something different. So the wonder as it's represented in the game is our own design, essentially, and rather than just picturing the aqueduct, it's picturing an irrigation network. You will have a source of whatever the wonder is, and then it will irrigate some parts of your city territory, and yeah, that's a new thing for Old World, procedural wonder.
Yeah, it looks really incredible though, once you've built it. The artists, Asher and Mark, did an amazing job with it.
Absolutely. And I just love how it, like, spiders across a couple of tiles from its actual build location.
Hmm.
And the next wonder we're going to introduce is the Royal Library. So the Royal Library gives you a global 20 civics per turn, and connected foreign cities give you a little bit of a science boost. Personally, this isn't a wonder I've played much with. I've sort of skipped over this one in favour of others, but I'm sure you, No Legs, have played with this one a bit.
I've played with this one a bit, actually. It's a feature of the current ongoing game I'm streaming on our channel, and I'm sort of finding out again about it, because most of my playtesting was in multiplayer and in duels, and of course it's a bonus for peace. It doesn't really work in duels, or at least not in duels against Fluffy Bunny, and And it's been rebalanced a little bit toward the end of the development. So I'm kind of finding out again, and I think it's cool that we have. Let's say it's a bit unique in the way it encourages peace. Old World can be quite a violent game sometimes, and the fact that we can have a bonus that rewards peace and diplomacy and exploration quite independently of your ability to fight and conquer the map is, I think, quite cool. So and also, as I'm a Mesopotamian nerd, the first big library. So we have two, I guess, great libraries in the game: the one in Alexandria and this one from Nineveh. So yeah, I like those aspects in the game.
Peace. That's probably why I haven't experienced this wonder much, because I tend to view my neighbors as nations building my cities for me later.
Yeah, I guess it's a common perception in the 4X world, I guess. But yeah, there's all kind of players in Old World, and very different ways to play, and so that's something we're trying to do with the design of such a DLC as well, to provide different things that we haven't done, like piling up on connected foreign cities, especially, for instance, in that case, and also rewarding or encouraging different kind of plays. So, yeah, so we'll see how it goes.
Okay, and the final wonder in the DLC is the... And I'm going to absolutely mash this. The Yazili Kaya. Please excuse my pronunciation.
The Yazili Kaya, absolutely. I'm cheating. I've had to say the word so many times. Communicating with artists. I have a bit of training. Well, saying it in English anyway, I have no idea how it's pronounced. Not how it should be pronounced. But,
So this wonder is built in a holy city, and it gives state religion cities plus 20% civics. So this is another quite a religious one, and can be quite beneficial for you if you've got a developed religion.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it's a bit different in the approach, because it's a bonus applying to all state religion cities. They don't have to be state religion cities at the time the wonder is completed. So it's a bit, let's say, and that's good, because it's one of the early wonders. It's available at Weak Culture. So plus 20% civic is a very significant bonus in all cities, because it applies to city production, not to the stockpile, compared to the effect from most wonders. So it's, let's say, similar to the Colossus, which provides plus 2 civics in connected cities, but it scales in a different manner. So although it has additional requirements, so yeah, I think it's pretty cool. And well, obviously it's probably visible. We tried to, let's say, spread our pick of wonders among the nations and the regions that are represented in the game. So having this complex from Anatolia, from what was the Hittite Empire, is quite cool, I think.
Yeah, it was originally in Hattusa, wasn't it?
Very close, yes. I think some 9-10 kilometers to the north of the city. And I'm sorry, because I worked with the artist, I compiled the reference material, so that's stuck in my mind for some reason. Yeah, quite close to Hattusa, outside of the city walls, but yeah.
So overall, in terms of balance, how do you think we went with the new wonders?
Well, we wanted to try some new effects, and so there was a bit of risk concerning that in terms of balance. We tend to view, and maybe that's a bit controversial, balance as something that, let's say, more important to multiplayer than to single player, because in single player, you can sort of pick your challenge. So that's why we feel that having dynasties not all being equal is fine, because they're not really intended for multiplayer, although that can be done for kind of a special game. Well, I guess we'll see, because the balance changed a little bit as we were playtesting and an integrated feedback. But once our full audience is playing it, of course we receive a lot more feedback, and of course we pay attention as always. So of course there might be adjustments, just as there were adjustments on the base game Wonders as well. So it will be interesting to see what people will come up with. There are new combos that arise as well, like the Necropolis provides a bonus on temples, and it was not so powerful a wonder in the base game, but now you can combine it with a Jebel Barkal and you can get free temples and they have more benefits, and so there are new combinations and possibilities that arise with the Wonders and Dynasties, and it's quite exciting not to be able to predict everything that will come out of it. So well, at least that's my perspective on it. So
yeah, no, I completely agree with that. It feels like with these Wonders we've gone a bit more situational maybe. So some of them are, yeah, like more specific, so maybe focus more towards a peaceful play style, or specifically have more polytheistic game. But yeah, like No Legs mentioned earlier, it's really fun encouraging players to try out different styles to how they'd normally play, and especially when they combine together, it really does change up the game a lot.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it's the fact that it's a DLC, so it's an addition, it's a bit different. In the base game we had a smaller set of Wonders, so they needed to be more or less balanced, because or work in most games, because we had a somewhat restricted set. It's more or less always the same, with a few exceptions. With now an expanded pool of 24 Wonders, on which a bit more than half are available in each game, well, sometimes this combination is available, sometimes not. Sometimes it will fit with the rest, with the map, with the nation you're playing, sometimes not so much. And I think it's, more open space for possibilities. And that's what we went for anyway.
Yeah, and I love how you guys talk about combinations and play styles, and I consider it min-max exploitation.
Well, I guess I can't help myself. I'm really a 4X player, so yeah. Yeah, I guess. I suppose that's why I'm here. Half of the time, when an exploit is detected before it's implemented, it's either it's Fluffy or myself, usually raising it in design meeting, because we tend to look at the game that way, I guess. But different players. That's good as well.
Or it's Soren and Alex bringing it up because one of you two have actually used it against them in one of our in-house team games.
possibly our in-house team game generated some internal feedback and interesting discussions, I'd say, but of course we won, and that's all that matters.
I'm sure they would consider it differently.
Yeah, won this time.
yes, but we'll see. Well, we wouldn't want to make faction. Maybe we should. We'll see. There's a discussion for the next one ongoing. So we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, to close out the Wonders discussion, No Legs, favorite wonder and why?
Oh, the Colossus. Colosseum, sorry. Because it was the first one when I... It was fully magic to me to say, all right, we want to do the Colosseum and to make a list of documentation about it and all that, and just see it come back. So I guess I was a bit more involved than the rest of the team, because once we were set as a team on the wonders we wanted to include, there were a few changes, but I did gather materials and communicate with the artists and all that, so I kind of saw all of them coming one by one, but the first one was the Colosseum, and that was the first one, the first time I was doing that kind of job, so it was a bit magical seeing the painting. Well, at least it blew my mind. I hope our players will like it, but I do definitely love it. So and it's kind of special because because it's the first one. So yeah, I love all of them, but the Colosseum is a bit special because of that.
And Josh, favorite wonder and why?
So I'm going to be cheeky and go for two. I think mechanically my favorite is the Carthon. Just because I hadn't, like you or Henry, played with the Navy at all, then I just had a really fun game on an inland sea map where I ended up getting the Carthon, and the whole game ended up being around naval battles, and it was just, yeah, the same, really fun, really different. But then in terms of art, it's got to be the German aqueduct. It just looks so cool. How about you, Dale?
For myself, I would say, for me, it's a toss-up between the Jebel Barkal and the Colosseum. The Colosseum, obviously, as I explained, it allows me to put less focus on melee techs, so I can focus my science elsewhere, because I'm getting those swordsmen every few turns. And the Jebel Barkal, because when I'm playing a religious game, just getting those temples into your world religion cities, it can give you quite a big boost, and it saves you all those resources, and it gets you straight into those temple specialists to give you those science boosts.
All right, so you're calling me a min-maxer, but I'm the one choosing the wonders for what they represent rather than their effect in games, so I'll note that.
I never said I was consistent.
sure, fair enough.
The other half of the Wonders and Dynasties DLC are the Dynasties, of course. And originally in Heroes of the Aegean, we introduced Dynasties with the Greeks. Now, Dynasties as a concept was born out of the desire to give players new leaders to play with. And then because we had those new leaders, we had to include the leaders' families. And therefore, it became the start of a new dynasty. And that is how the concept was born. And because player feedback was that they really enjoyed the different dynasties and the different play styles that were available to Greece, we then pushed it forward with the new nation of Kush when we published Pharaohs. And now that we've come to Wonders and Dynasties, we've opened up dynasties for every nation within the game. So the way we did it was, as designers, we all got together and we all grabbed nations that took our fancy and then went off and researched and came back with a list of names and abilities and what dynasty features we wanted with those new leaders. And through discussions with the team and feedback, we then narrowed it down, refined them, and we came up with what is in the game now. So No Legs decided to pick Mesopotamia. So No Legs, would you like to talk about your nations?
Yeah, so Mesopotamia is not a nation in the game, so that meant Assyria and Babylonia, but for some reason, I got quite fascinated by the history of the period and the region. I guess I'm drawn toward, let's say, the earliest part of the scope of the game. So, well, obviously, Sumeria was there, and there's an affiliation. It got into quite a rabbit hole, really, in documenting. That's how we ended up implementing hieroglyphs and cuneiform in the game, and I'm not sure how many game support writing in cuneiform and hieroglyphs, but that was quite fun. And yeah, the way we went, so we did our documentation, of course, are design consideration, trying to offer different play styles. So we don't want to have like a set of four different military leaders, let's say, or military focused. But also, I know for the one that I worked with, I tried to have a spread about the history of Babylon. So in the game, what we have are Neo-Assyria and the Neo-Babylonian Empire, which are quite late in the history, but they are key figures that we couldn't miss. Like, it's not having Hammurabi in a game with Babylon, it felt like if we have several leaders, it needs to be part of it. And we also wanted to represent different aspects. So in my case, I picked some leaders from several of the dynasties that are implicitly in the game via families. So for instance, the Nisin period, which translates into a Nisin family for Babylon. So I wanted to have a leader from that family, and one from the Kassites, and etc. So trying to give a spread of both representing the nation as fairly as we could, including being a bit geeky with cuneiform support or hieroglyphs and old Persians and all that, and to offer different options as well. So there's no military options for a setup for Babylonia, or on the opposite side, there are peaceful options or more builder-oriented options for Assyria. So so yeah, that's at least how we tried to go about it, I think, or definitely I tried to go about it for my dynasties, or the ones I worked on. Yeah, one of the interesting parts is that there are many of them in the end. So I don't think anyone on the team has played all the dynasties. So yeah, it's very interesting to see feedback and to try new things as well. Because we are still discovering ourselves some parts of what our colleague did. So that's quite exciting for me anyway.
And out of your two nations that you chose, Assyria and Babylonia, which would you say is your favorite dynasty?
I guess there are different things. I tried to do some strange things with the design. So I quite enjoy Shamuramat because, well, first, she's an awesome woman leader. There's the historical figure. There's also a legend associated with her, and the ability to switch archetype was something that I thought very interesting, and also there are opposite archetypes. She can be a builder or a hero, more or less at your whim. There's a cooldown, but and I can say I've fully explored myself the possibilities, but cool things can appear with opinions, because obviously if your oligarch is a builder, when you're a builder he loves you, but when you're a hero he despises you. So I thought those kind of things were introducing cool dynamics, and I quite enjoy Nebuchadnezzar. So he's Nebuchadnezzar one, I mean, because his specialty is quite subtle. He gets a pair of free units, a scout and a slinger, on clearing his first camp, and that doesn't sound like much, but it's very significant as a boost in the early game, and it could enable the design of a character with some traits that are rarely picked. He's a tracker tactician, so it's a combination that's available in the base game, but not so common. But they both go in the same direction, because you get a huge visibility bonus with being a tactician leader, and also a strong visibility bonus with being a tracker. So he has he's not only military but also very good at exploring with his first units and explore scouts and all that. And I thought that was I was pleased with the design, let's say.
Yes, I have to say, when I tried. I call him the Chad, Nebuchadnezzar. I really enjoyed, well, one thing I found was that he's powerful in those first few turns, because when you do conquer your first barbarian or tribal camp, you literally double your army. And that can be extremely powerful at such an early turn.
Yeah, but you have to get the value out of it. And that's more or less true for all dynasties, because by default, most of the bonuses only apply to the starting leaders. So you don't get to keep it the whole game. So you have to... you don't have to, but... to get the most out of what they offer, you have to consider what they are doing in the way you play. So, and I think it's a good thing, a bit like ambitions are doing in the game, to have an incentive for players to try something different from what they're used to.
Agreed. And Nebuchadnezzar is a great example where you have the option that your second build doesn't have to be a military unit. You could switch back and create another settler or create a scout to take use of the extra vision. Like, you know, normally, well, the way I play is after the initial settler, I'll build another military unit and then go back to a settler. But with Nebuchadnezzar, with going for that first barbarian or tribal camp, you don't necessarily need that second military build.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, it's different, and generally they are more powerful than the base leader. Not all of them, but most of them. It's interesting. So, and one thing I'd like to mention about the dynasties I worked on. So I got sucked into the rabbit hole of all rabbit holes when I started working on it, because I had to come up with the right names, and the right names are in Akkadian, well, Neo-Assyrian or Babylonian. And I went into the full rabbit hole of trying to decipher cuneiform and to source information. And, it went unnoticed, but since about a year when we started the design of Wonders and Dynasties, because it's been some time coming, I actually had my work double-checked by an actual Assyriologist regarding the names of the characters, and that was awesome to get to go to that length with the rabbit hole. So there you go, we have an Assyriologist credited in the game, and we got our work double checked. So that was a cool anecdote.
That's awesome. And I have to admit, I'm guilty of falling down rabbit holes too, but for different nations.
Yeah, quite a few of us are quite geeky, I think, regarding our own interests, but fascinating to work in that environment as well.
There is a lot of love for history in the team.
Speaking of, do you want to talk about Egypt?
Yes, so I chose Egypt for obvious reasons, considering I worked on the Pharaohs of the Nile scenarios. So I chose Egypt, and the direction I wanted to take was I wanted to include a few of the famous Egyptian pharaohs that everyone knows of. For example, Ramses II or Ramses the Great, or the great ancestor as he's known as. But I also wanted to expose some not so well-known great pharaohs of Egypt. And the first one I chose was actually from the first dynasty, and her name is Merneith. And I wanted to focus on different periods of Egypt's history, because they went through different periods where they had different goals. Like, for instance, with Merneith during her era, it was focusing on using the Nile as a way to expand and create Egypt, the empire that we know of. And then as we move further on, like, for instance, Khufu is the next leader, and he focuses on wonders, like, obviously, because of the Great Pyramids. Because himself, his father, and his vizier were all famous for building the pyramids, perfecting them, And as you go further on, you get to Mentahotep, who is of the Middle Kingdom. And during his period was a time of centralization of government. And it was the first time that Pharaoh had ultimate power within the entire empire. And so his mission-based focus, you know, means that he can do more himself and not need counselors. And then as we go into the New Kingdom period with Akhenaten and Ramses II, they focus on different areas of empire building, as in like expanding to great lengths. And with Ramses II, he culminates in both a military focus and a building focus. And also, he's also long-lived, because Ramses II was the second longest-living pharaoh, Pepi the First being the longest one. Pepi the First reigned for like 96 years. But Ramses II was the second longest. But he was also, his reign is noted because of great building, great expansion, and plus also the wars with Hatti. You know, and if you remember from Pharaohs of the Nile, you've got the Battle of Kadesh, which is the biggest chariot battle in the world. It's one of the most well documented. It resulted in the first peace treaty in the world. And of course, because it's Ramses, he has to be in there. And so that was the focus I tried to take with Egypt.
I should remember to call him Ozymandias, just to trigger you, I suppose. But I guess that's a tidbit we should maybe emphasize. We went for the original name. I know, before starting to read about Egypt, I knew Khufu as Cheops as well. So quite often, history has retained, popular history has retained the later names given by Greeks and all that. But of course, as in the original game, we went back to the original names as much as we could. So. And I think it's cool to try to give, let's say, fair representation to those cultures.
Absolutely. I wanted to expose their Egyptian names, and also with the ones who start in different cities, like, for instance, Akhenaten starts in the city of Akhetaten. I wanted to use the proper Egyptian names as well. Here's an interesting one for you. When you actually play the Egyptian characters, and I'm sure that's true for some of the other nations too, if you hover over the leader portrait down in the bottom left, part of the tooltip that you see, it will give their historical name in the original writing of that period. So for Egypt, it's in hieroglyphics. And if I remember correctly, you did it for the Mesopotamian nations as well, didn't you, No Legs?
Yeah. Absolutely, and I went a little bit direct with that, because I used the historical name directly in the start event, so you can't escape the cuneiform. It will display on your screen whether you want it or not. So that will happen.
Sadly, no exciting font for Rome.
Well, isn't the Roman font just our font?
Well, exactly.
You'd have to write it all in Latin, though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but I mean, that's for pretty much all of them, it's just what it is already.
Or if you're talking about the true Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, it'd be in Greek, wouldn't it?
Heresy.
just to stir the pot a bit with some historians that I know.
Yeah, sure. It's interesting as well to see the community pickup. We've had I've seen extended discussion on the exact status of the Byzantine or Eastern Roman Empire and the debates about that. And I think it's quite cool to see the community, or at least part of the community, share in the fascinations we all had, or got, I guess, playing the game with the time period. So,
and no matter which Roman Empire you do support, I think we can all happily agree that the Holy Roman Empire is not Roman. nor was it holy.
We should start calling it the Northern Roman Empire, maybe, or something like that. I don't know.
So I know a lot of our players have found that Egyptian dynasty Khufu plays a little bit easier than some of the other leaders. Well, I'm sorry to say, but in the latest main update, we actually nerfed Khufu. So he now has a family penalty whenever he completes a wonder, as in, like, you know, the family's going, oh my God, he's making another wonder. What on earth?
Yeah, absolutely. And you, Josh, how did you go about picking in Rome, I guess, because it's, well, obviously, well, super well documented, and there are plenty of very well-known figures in Rome, so.
Too many well-known figures, one could say. With Rome, it was really a struggle to cut it down and pick which ones, really. So, again, really wanted quite a widespread, both of different types of characters and different play styles as well. So, like, because the time period of Old World in general kind of leans earlier, I kind of went for more Roman Republic for most of them, with kind of more like later Republic, because I mean, that's the time, partly I think it's the time most people know, like people from, so like Julius Caesar and Augustus are really kind of the two most well known. And then, yeah, also I did a degree in ancient history, kind of focused on that bit, so I'm just like really interested in that time period, so that was kind of a natural starting point as well. And then from there is really the mechanics dictated a lot of it. So Rome's already probably the most military focused of the base game nations, with their bonuses to training stuff. So kind of wanted to lean into that with some of them in quite different ways. So Julius Caesar is military focused, but very against tribes, so gets a bonus against tribal units, and can like level up and promote his units very quickly. Then, like, Gaius Marius is a bit different, so he's more about recruiting units and can build a big army. And that's partly inspired by the history. There's kind of the whole thing of the Marian reforms, which is one of these ideas where it is now kind of disputed how much it's actually a thing, and especially how much it can be attributed to, like, specifically to him. But it makes for really interesting gameplay, so we're putting it in there. And then Scipio is another one, from, he's the earliest chronologically, and he fought against Hannibal, and he's military focused well, but gets a bonus when fighting against other nations, and he's actually got some quite fun events, especially if you manage to defeat Hannibal with him. Or if you're doing very well in a war against Hannibal. So that's something to look out for. And then, yeah, with the other ones, it's just kind of mixing it up with different playstyles. So Agrippina is who went for as the kind of representative of the Roman Empire, or kind of the kind of right in the middle of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, because she's, yeah, kind of surrounded by all these emperors, like, have been a descendant of the dynasty, and then being married to Claudius, and married to Claudius, sister of Caligula. I always get the names mixed up, but yeah. And then obviously the like famous one is her son was Nero, and he's in there and is insane, as you'd expect, and has some really fun events, and she's got access to Spymaster, to she has access to spy masters right from the beginning of the game as her ability, so it's really fun just having that part of the game just out of the gate. It lets you play around with all the missions and get straight to assassinating people. And then my personal favourite, and probably the weirdest, is Sulla, who's a dictator. So the way that plays in the game is he's got a negative family opinion, and it gets worse over time, so all the families dislike you by default. But then you've got a special mission that lets you target the families, basically to use a fun combination of blackmail and murder to terrorise them to stay on side. So all fun and games in Roman politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, makes me want to play the game and to explore a little bit, because of course we focus on the founders, the starting leaders, but dynasties being what they are, we include other characters. So there are things to be found out about a bit all over the place. I know, for instance, all the members of the Sargonid dynasty for Neo-Assyria would have been eligible for greatness, but I had to pick, so I picked Sargon, because he's essentially the one who named the dynasty. But his son, Sennacherib, was possibly the greatest leader of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, and he's kind of a hidden power, a bit like Kashaya with Nebuchadnezzar in the base game, because she starts as a schemer, so very high wisdom and all of that. So or Alexander within Philip dynasty, and I'm sure all of us have hidden relationships and all that, and all the events and what can arise from there. So
Yeah, there's so many extra characters, like both in family trees, and I know some have extra courtiers as well, like Agrippina. You also start with Seneca as a court minister. And the events, so I think pretty much every dynasty has a few events tied to it as well, and some of them are very mechanical and are very regular, and then there's some, like the Khal Sala one mentioned earlier, the Scipio one I mentioned. There's some which have really specific things that you need to do, but are really fun if you find them. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of hidden things like that to look out for.
Yeah, I guess that's the nature of events. It lends itself to Easter eggs that will appear only in specific situations, but can be very rewarding to find. Of course, it's a fine balance. We want people to experience what we make, I think I feel like playing Rome again now that you.
What I love so much about the dynasties in this DLC is that there's such a wide range and so varied. Like, we all really tried to go out of our way to provide different styles of play. And, I mean, that's like just looking through the leaderheads in the Choose a Leader menu, and you can see that it's going to provide so many hours of fun just trying each character. You know, you've got, you know, pretty easy characters, you know, like Khufu is probably one of the easiest to play with his wonder ability, and, you know, really good for a beginner player because it focuses on building and getting you quickly towards victory. But then there are completely insane dynasties, you know, like Agrippina, like, sure, she's powerful to start with, but then you get Nero, you know, and if you want to go completely insane, have a look at Akhenaten, who starts off as an insane religious zealot.
What a combo.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, like, and I've noticed that some dynasties open up more ways to play, but then other dynasties restrict how you can play, but in ways that you probably never usually do. And so they will open up new events to you, new ways that the game interacts with you, new ways that other leaders will react to you. You know, and it just provides something completely different each leader that you play. And that's what I love so much about this DLC.
Yeah, it can provide a challenge, and as well, like, just getting out of the usual setup. So, and of course, having an insane leader lends itself to writing some pretty funny events, even in the base game. So, on top of what's specific to each dynasty is just getting to experience some of those traits that you would naturally avoid normally. You'll probably find out about some events that you had never seen before. So,
yeah, and I love that we provided events specifically for most of the dynasties. You know, so you won't see those events unless you play that leader, and you know, there's a lot of fun. So the three of us have been able to talk about the dynasties that we contributed to, but unfortunately with Carthage, Hatti, and Persia, the three of us weren't involved in the development of those dynasties, so you'll just have to play them to find out how interesting they are. And of course, Greece and Kush, they were developed in previous DLCs. So we're coming to the end of this podcast, and just to wrap up, out of the whole DLC, No Legs, what would be your favorite feature, and do you have any final comments about the DLC for our players?
Well, I think, well, really, let's say, opening up the space of what can be done with the game, and we made a few departures even in, let's say, creative design with the German Aqueduct, as we mentioned, or even the fact that we named the wonders specifically in the base game. You don't have the Colossus of Rhodes, you have just the Colossus, or you don't have the Pyramid of Gizeh, you have the Pyramids, and we had to get more specific to introduce more variety there. So quite a few new things, and I think, well, of course, from our side, as a, let's say, a creative experience, that was quite exciting and interesting, but also just as a player, because I still perceive myself as a player first, because that's what I was first, or this game, just the sheer amount of new possibilities and ways to think about the game, even as a min-maxer, finding new combinations and all that is very cool. And of course, dynasties being based on history lend themselves very well to storytelling, so that's quite a cool aspect as well. And I definitely, the thing I enjoy the most is that it's out, because I've been following the development for a very long time, especially on the, let's say, the producing part with the art teams, and I've been dying to share our designs, our art, and what we made since about a year ago, and it's finally out. We can play it in the MP community. We can see the feedback of players and interact with that. So surely there'll be more balance and patches and support as we always do. But it's hard to pick a favorite, but I'm super glad that it's out and that we get to share it with everyone, essentially.
Definitely. And Josh, how about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think as we've talked about a few times throughout this podcast, my favorite thing about the DLC is really just how it changes things up, how it makes you approach a strategy differently, encourages you to play in different ways, and personally, like, from how I play, like, I'm kind of the opposite of Ben. I tend to focus way more on the storytelling than min-maxing or anything like that, and having, yeah, all these different characters and the events and all the different families, I'm just so excited to dive into, there's just so many of them, as we said, like, you know, none of us have been able to get our way through all of them yet, so yeah, it's just so many different possibilities. How about you, Dale?
So with myself, Yeah, I'm going to be boring and also say that it's, you know, the different ways of the players can play the game. Like, you know, new wonder combinations, new dynasty combinations, like the permutations of how the game is actually going to start is going to be so many more times what it was with just the base game. You know, when you consider we're now giving you 24 wonders, we're now giving you like heaps of dynasties to play with, you know, and the fact that every game will randomize that to some extent, like the permutations are just so many now that it's going to take such a long time to get through all of them. And personally, I'm really looking forward to diving into what remains of the combinations that I haven't tried yet.
Absolutely. I think there are subtle effects that we're just finding out about. Some aspects I didn't think really about, even if before really playing with some of the dynasties, is that, for instance, when you play on pre-made maps that are geographically accurate, there are quite a few opposition between leader. Let's say Greece starts with a commander and Rome with a tactician. So by default, they just don't like each other. Or Nebuchadnezzar is a scholar and Ashurbanipal is a zealot. So by default, they don't like each other and they are neighbors on pre-made maps. It's not as tense between Persia and Egypt because they're a bit further away, but that really conditioned the way those maps had to be played because there was one set of leaders. So if you were playing with preset leaders, then that was conditioning your relations with the neighboring nations, and that's gone away. You don't know what you'll be facing and what might be happening. So even in that context, there are, let's say, new increased variety in ways we didn't necessarily really strongly think about at the outset, but it's cool to find this new this wider space, let's say.
And it's interesting you mentioned the pre-made maps. Something we haven't even touched on in this podcast is that what we've done with the dynasties is, on the pre-made maps, they start in that dynasty's historical capital city. So, for instance, the Ptolemies will start in Alexandria in Egypt. Merneith starts in Memphis, whereas some of the other Egyptian leaders will start in Waset. So we've taken that, and so it's going to create interesting combinations as well. Like, for instance, if you've got Ptolemy and Ramses II both on the same pre-made map, they're literally going to be within squares of each other because Ramses II starts in Pi Ramses, which is on the other side of the Nile Delta from Alexandria. So that's even going to create different permutations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even us are still finding out about what it will do to the game, and that's, I guess, we're exciting to see what people will come up with.
And Josh, we know that the DLC is currently out. Where can our listeners pick up the DLC from?
All the usual suspects, so Steam, Epic, Good Old Games.
This brings us to the conclusion of our podcast, and I would like to thank both No Legs and Josh for joining me here on the panel today.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Dale.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be here and to get to talk about Wonders and Dynasties.
So if you have any questions about the Wonders and Dynasties DLC, Old World, history in general, or even just want to come and have a chat with No Legs Kitten, Josh, or myself, you can find us on the Old World Discord server, which you can find as a link in the main menu of the game. Thank you so much for listening today, and all three of us hope that you enjoy the game. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.